How y'all doing? I was driving up here. My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables group, but I haven't found it necessary to have a drink, nor have I had a drink. You know, you got to say that. You know, about two guys in Texas. One guy was at a meeting and said, I haven't found it necessary to have a drink in 20 years. And the other guy said, well, I saw you drunk last night. He said, yeah, but it wasn't necessary. Well, I haven't found it necessary to have a drink, nor have I had a drink since January 25th, 1981. And I'm grateful to that. And it's great to be here. I was driving up with a crew. We had our crew together. I had Pastor Carrie Miller here, one of my pastors. He's been evangelizing for 67 years. And Pastor John Glenn, my sponsor, who's got 57 years sobriety, somewhere in the audience. And Garrett. Where's Garrett? Garrett, how much time you have now?
6 months.
6 months. He's doing great. He's doing great. And Paul, who drove up here, so I appreciate that. We travel in packs. I believe in that. Maybe I'll go into that a little bit, you know. And people travel in packs, you know, stay sober for long periods of time. And there's a reason for that. You know, fellowship is very important. Particular types of fellowship are important. I want to talk a little bit about that. You'll find as this goes on, my sponsor said... My first sponsor, I've had three sponsors. You know, some people come up to me and says, will you be my temporary sponsor? I said, I don't know how to nail that permanently, you know. And my first sponsor died after about 7 or 8 years of cancer, and he had like 20 years sobriety. My second sponsor, Joe Snyder, died with 35 years sobriety, cancer. So, you know, you meet these incredible men, and they move on. They pass on. And you want to have everything they have. You want what they have. And I said, man, if I could only have 5% of whatever the heck that guy's got going for him. And Bill Wilson spoke about something called emotional sobriety, which is what this entire thing I'm doing this next 12 weeks will be about. It's not going to be about drinking. I can't help you with the drinking. You have to go to another meeting for that. Or you have to drink. I think in order to stop drinking, you really have to drink. You don't want to come in here prematurely. You know what it says in the big book? He says, we don't argue with people about drinking. He says, why don't you go out and try some controlled drinking. We let John Barleycorn, got a name for booze, do our argument for you. I think the two things that you got to know in AA is number one, you got to drink to get here. And number two, once you get here, you're really supposed to stop. It's a basic tenet of the program. But most people I talk to in AA over the last 32 plus years have been sober. And, well, they've been physically sober. Very few have been rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence or experienced much of heaven. It's very easy to be in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You only need a desire to stay sober. It used to be an honest desire. They took out the word honest. That was like too high a bar, you know, for alcoholics. So just to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you just have to have a desire. We're talking about a fleeting thought, but it's a whole of the deal if you want to become a member of the Fellowship of the Spirit. That's a whole different thing they talk about on the last page. The Fellowship of the Spirit, which actually comes from, is coined from a verbiage, I think, in the book of, it's either Corinthians or Philippians. I'm not sure which one, because for the first 4 years, that's what they used in Alcoholics Anonymous. That was when they say, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Their path was to read the Holy Bible, and the books they found absolutely essential was 1 Corinthians 13, the Sermon on the Mount, which is Matthew 5, 6, and 7, and the book of James. We were almost called the James Gang. And so I'm going to talk mostly about emotional sobriety. Bill Wilson said the problem with alcoholics is that they suffer from unhealthy dependencies. There's not going to be a whole lot of talk about drinking, except insofar as it impinges upon or has to do with emotional sobriety or lack thereof. I went to a meeting that I never go to. I just happened to go to this meeting that I haven't been to in about 20 years, a small meeting, about 10 or 15 people. And most of the people in there had about 20 years plus. And it was very, very interesting for me to be at that meeting because I never saw a set of crew in my life. It was an incredible illustration to me as to what it's like to have 20 years or 25 years of sobriety and be hanging in there. And I'll tell you, whatever they had going for them, I didn't want any of that stuff, you know. I wanted the stuff my sponsors had, you know, what they promised me. They said we'd experience... What? What? Oh, what's that? Somebody get the Viagra. We're going to talk a little bit about... Yeah. Yeah. Give it a drug or something. We'll talk a little bit about Viagra, breast augmentation and stuff. That'll come later on. Talk about that. Yeah. Well, listen, it gets worse. This is like nothing. This is orientation. When I came in here, they said you want to lower your expectations. You know, because this is a first step meeting, don't make a mistake of thinking that we're going to talk anything about the first step. Well, you know, the deal is, I've been doing this for a long time, and I know you're going to get out of this whatever you're supposed to get out of this, no matter what I'm saying. One of the stories that I have, one of the tapes is, what's it called, the Chicken on the Roof tape? It's a true story. I went down and I gave a talk down in, about 30 years ago, down at the Homestead Group, and I thought it was the worst third step in the history, and the fourth step in the annals of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't going to go back. I thought it was terrible, but I went back the next week, and some guy walked up to me after what I thought was the worst fourth step in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he walked up to me and says, "You saved my life." He says, "You saved my life." That meeting saved my life. I thought they hated me. I thought it was the worst meeting. He says, "You saved my life." And then he proceeded to tell me that when you said the chickens on the roof, my entire life changed. He said, you know, my wife had left me. She had taken my kid. I was all alone. I only have 2 months. I was going to get a drink. And I said, you know, maybe I'll stop into this meeting for one last thing. I was sitting in the back of the room and you were talking. And when you said the chicken was on the roof, all of a sudden everything came together for me. And I understood everything. And, well, of course, I had never said the chicken was on the roof. I mean, don't get me wrong. I knew what he was talking about because there was a part I was talking some poultry there, you know. But what I say, he got it all wrong. He said, I said the turkey was in the basement. Of course, I took credit for it. I said, yeah, chicken on the roof, I always say. Me, that's my famous line, chicken on the roof. You know? And, you know, I learned a couple of things from that meeting. You know, it's funny how you learn those things. Number one, I learned a little bit about the 12 step, you see, because one of the reasons why I was so, I guess, upset about that meeting, of course, one of the basic reasons is because if you're an alcoholic, you're also a please love me a holic, please accept me a holic, don't reject me a holic, tell me that you admire me a holic. You're all those holics too, you know. And so, you know, you're always looking for approval and you're always looking for that kind of deal going on. And of course, you're codependent. Being an alcoholic means you're also dependent upon worrying about what other people think about you. You know, I mean, I know basically alcoholics, you know, we walk around and tell ourselves, I don't give a shit what they think about me. I don't care what they think about me. Sometimes we even say that out loud. We say, I don't give a crap what they think about me. We'll say that in bars and stuff, you know. There are probably people in here who have thought that to themselves. I don't give a crap what they think about me. But, you know, after you've been around for a while, you know that people who tell themselves they don't give a crap what other people think about them, and people who say things like, I don't give a crap what they think about me, all they do is think about what other people think about them. People that really don't give a crap what other people think about them don't say, I don't give a crap what people think about me. Don't even think about that stuff. They say things like, pass the salt, I'll have them malted, you know. I don't know what they say, but they don't say that stuff. But, you know, but when you're selfish and self-centered, which is the basis of this disease, and you're driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and you know, 100 forms of fear, self-delusion. That means if you know 3 of them, you've got them nailed, and you suspect 10 more, you know, you only got like 80, you know, 77 more to figure out, you know. Step on the toes of others, they retaliate. Usually we're self will run riot. That's why we want to manage our lives, because all we do is we want to do what we want to do. Self will run riot, though, we usually don't think so. Above all, we must get rid of the selfishness. Yeah, or it kills us. That's what it says. It kills us. I've seen a lot of alcoholics die. They die physically. They die emotionally. They die spiritually in here. They die. They must or it kills. It says God makes that possible. Which is probably why they say, see to it your relationship with him is right and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. Which is probably why they say, there is one who has all power. One, that one is God. May you find him now. Which is probably why they say, you can't manage your own life. No human power can help you with this. Only God could and would if he was sought. Which is probably why they say, if you sincerely take the position that you're not God and you turn your life over to him and he's the Father, all sorts of remarkable things happen. Being all-powerful, he'll give you everything you need if you stay close to him and perform his works well. You know, you'll lose fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. It's probably why they say we don't apologize for God, that our life is on a new basis, that it's all about God. It's probably why they say in AA, all we do is talk about how we develop our relationship with God. It's probably why they say, you know, job or no job, wife or no wife, let no alcoholic say he's got to, needs his family back. All he needs is a relationship with God. It's probably why they talk about God all through the book. It's probably why the whole book is only about God and developing your relationship with God. How sad it is to walk into a group of people with 20, 25 years that don't have a relationship with God. All they know about is the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they've been doing. How sad it is to be with a group of people who've been around here for 20 years, and they think that this whole darn thing is about not drinking and going to meetings. They bought into that treatment center stuff, which is nothing wrong with that. I mean, you can argue against not drinking and go to meetings. It's easy. It's non-confrontational. It doesn't hurt anybody's feelings. You don't have to really believe in anything. You know what I mean? It doesn't call you to anything higher than just don't drink and go to meetings. Sort of like, don't drink and go to therapy. Don't drink and just hang out, you know? You know, how sad. And how sad it is after 5 or 10 years to have people that are still working that deal. And they know all about the steps, and they know all about the big book, and they know all about the meetings, but they don't know anything about God, and they have no relationship with God. How sad it is to run into somebody with 20 years who's just hanging in there, who's so lonely at 3 o'clock in the morning, will always be lonely, always feel apart. And we go into meetings because they need meetings, because they have to have meetings. And there's nothing wrong with having to be with other people, but they have to have it because outside of the meetings, their life is so desperately horrible because they live lives of quiet desperation. How sad it is to miss this whole deal and spend so much time and not really even understanding what this thing is about. So most of the stuff that I talk about or I preach about or whatever you want to say about it has to do with that, has to do with emotional sobriety, and that's what we're probably going to talk about tonight. So so this is from the story, He Sold Himself Short. You know, it says in the big book, the AA started in 1935. You all understand that? 1935. Do you have any mathematicians in here? The big book was written in 1939. It started in 35. It was written in 39. What's the difference?
4 years.
4 years. 4 long years. In the big book, this is what they wrote. And if you don't get this, this is going to be a tough deal for you. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Has anybody ever heard that before? I think they said it at this meeting. You know, the secret is in listening to the words. You can read this book all the way through quickly. See the things you don't want to see, not see the things you see, and, you know, get the stuff you get. And at the very end, come to the conclusion that acceptance is the answer to all your problems, which is not true. Because if acceptance was the answer to all our problems, we wouldn't have a big book. We'd have a matchbook cover. So when the guy comes up to me at the meeting in the Homestead group and says, you saved my life because that chicken on the roof thing, and I had said the turkey was in the basement. This is like Pulp Fiction. Anybody ever see Pulp Fiction? You know, like you start in the beginning and in the middle and it goes to the end and it goes all over. Like if you turn to go to the bathroom, you've lost it. You know what I mean? You've got to like follow this thing. I'm going to make some hard rights, you know. And so you remember in the Homestead group, the guy says when you said the chicken was on the roof? And I had actually said the turkey was in the basement. And one of the things I learned about that is I thought my job, the reason I was disappointed is I thought my job was to carry the message. That's what I thought my job was, to carry the message. In other words, I'm responsible, like, you know, for making you laugh, for making you cry, for having an effect, or you're not drinking. In other words, if you go out and drink, it's my fault because it wasn't a good meeting or not a good for, you know. And I thought I had done the worst meeting. It probably was the worst meeting that I ever done in my life, you know. But it was the best meeting I could do that night. And after that meeting, I realized that what it actually said in the 12th step is that we try to carry the message. That I don't even have to carry a good message. All I have to do is do the best I can. Because what had happened is, and this is the way it works, is I got up there and did the best meeting I could do that night. Probably the worst meeting in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this poor schlub comes in the meeting, he's looking to drink, he's looking to drug, he thinks his life is over, he's there just for anything, any relief, just hoping maybe this guy or somebody will say something. He's sitting in the back of the room and I say turkey in the basement, and it flies across that room. It goes all the way over to the other end where he's sitting trying to figure out what this thing is all about. And it goes in his ears, turkey in the basement, and God knows the piece that's missing in his heart, and turns into the chicken on the roof, and he's healed, and I get the credit. So I've spoken all over the world, and you know, people come up to me after an hour of talking. One guy says, "Oh man, when you said this," another guy said, "When you said that," and they're all talking about different parts of the talk. They each heard one sentence, you know. And one guy's working on the 10th step, and he doesn't even know what he needs is a third step. And one guy's working on, he knows I need to do a fifth step, and he doesn't even know what he really needs to know about is the second step. And they don't know anything. All they know is in a 1 hour talk, they heard one thing. And it was the most important thing they had to hear. And they don't even know what step it applies to, but it was important they needed to hear it. And it's the same talk. And it's like if there's 100 people, it's 100 different talks. You know, and I think there's an old Chinese proverb. If 100 people cross a bridge, it's 100 different bridges. You know, so, you know, I mean, the bottom line is you're going to get out of this whatever you're going to get out of this. And since the steps are infused and God is infused in everything we do, every step is going to be involved in this meeting. And whatever step you need, whatever principle you need, if that's what you ask God to put in your life, you're going to get out of this deal. And if you're not looking to Him and you don't want this deal and it's not important to you, don't worry about it, because you just won't get anything. It won't bother you at all. It'll just be 1 hour out of your time. So here it is. Occasionally, it says he sold himself short, which is one of the stories. Now, in the book they said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, which I paraphrase to mean, and I think this is pretty much what it means. You know, I understand this is all my opinion. I could be wrong. No use getting upset. I'll probably say all sorts of goofy things. You'll get all upset about something. On the way home, I'll change my mind. I'll say, why did I say that? You know, God forbid I should piss somebody off. You know how bad that would make me feel. You know, if I piss you off, you know what the spiritual axiom is? Whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you. So if I get you upset, you owe me like a copayment. It's like a spiritual MRI. And the way this, let me tell you how this works. I get you upset, I say something. I say something that's absolutely off the wall that drives you crazy. It drives you crazy because if it's true, that means you have to change. And because you're an alcoholic and you think you're a piece of shit anyway, you think I'm talking down to you and you get all buzzed out over it and everything like that. And so what happens is you walk out of here and you're livid. You can't get me off my mind. I can't believe that son of a bitch. I'm never going back here. Why would they let that guy? You're going nuts. Now, of course, I'm not even thinking about you. I'm going to go get some ice cream or something. But in any event, you're going nuts. And so you do one of two things. You think about me, you think about it, you reflect on it, you resent me and everything like that, and because of the resentment or whatever it is, it builds more resentments, more stuff happens. Your mind is just a variegated piece of whatever, it's going crazy, and you eventually drink and either die or come back in here with a new attitude. Or you go back, you pray about it, you think about it, you consider things, you read the big book, maybe you do a four-step inventory to try to figure out why is this guy bothering me so much. All of a sudden, you see some sort of problem with yourself. You see something going on. And all of a sudden, in the midst of all that, maybe you talk to your sponsor. You see, you know something? You know, that son of a bitch is right about that one thing. And that's why it bothers me, because of blah, blah, blah. And all of a sudden, it doesn't bother you anymore. But not only don't I bother you anymore, you realize that whatever it is I was bothering you, I'm just a symbol of 1,000 other assholes out there that have been bothering you. Because I'm just basically the guy tonight that's bothering you, but that thing, same thing that's about me that's been bothering you, was got you fired from that last job, is why you got divorced from your wife, why you never got along with your father-in-law, why you can't get along with your son, and all of a sudden a whole level of stuff that's been bothering you out there is like gone. It doesn't bother you anymore, because I don't bother you. And that's how we grow in here and become adults. By running the people that bother us and challenge us and getting through that and figuring out why they bother us, and somehow instead of the world changes, we change, and all of a sudden we're not botherable. And if you're not botherable or not upsettable, that means you're not restless, irritable, and discontented. And since men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol, because they are restless, irritable, and discontented, unless they can experience a sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. In other words, the reason we drink is because we can't stand being sober. Because to be sober and an alcoholic is to be pissed off, upset, high, low. I can't believe this has happened to me. Who the hell do they think they are? They don't know who they're screwing with. You know, that I'll show them. It's to be somehow, some way, over a period of time. I don't know what it is, but whatever insulation the Lord gives man to handle the bullshit out there, the billboards, the TV shows, the bosses, the bounce checks, the everybody that goes on, you know, whatever the insulation the Lord gives people, human beings, in order to handle life. I see other people handling it so well. I'm always comparing my inside with other people's outsides. They look like they're gliding through life and things are so tough for me. Whatever that insulation is, I didn't get it. I was going along that conveyor belt, getting ready to get slugged with that insulation. And somebody said, God, and he looked up, he said, yes, and I went by and that screwed from the beginning, you know? And that was the deal, you know? So in 1939, they said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, which I think means if you do what we did thoroughly, you will get what we got. And one of the things they got, they said, we've experienced much of heaven. We've been rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence of which we have not even dreamed, which is different than we stopped drinking. What do you think? I think it's different than we stopped drinking. Because they handled we stopped drinking in the first paragraph. Said we are 100 men and women who have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. And I know what a hopeless state of mind and body is. I know what they're talking about. They're talking about that not drinking thing, that drinking against your will. They're talking about waking up in the morning and saying, I'm not going to drink today. And by 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you're drinking. Waking up in the morning and saying, I'm not going to go to the bar today. And by 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you're going to the bar. Waking up in the morning and saying, I'm not going to buy alcohol today. And by 5 o'clock in the afternoon, you're searching for dimes, sickles, and quarters so you can get up $2.89 and get a quart bottle of Carlos Rossi Cante, which you can drink next to your LP record, the same cut, running on empty, over and over and over and over again. You know what I mean? And you do it again and again and again and again until you're 31 years old and you know your life is over and you'll never be better again. And you wish you were dead, but you're scared of dying. And you can't envision life without drinking. Can't say, I know what that's all about. When you're drinking, when you finally get to the point where you're drinking against your will, when you don't want to drink and you swear you're not going to drink and you say, today I'm not going to have a drink, and you end up drunk anyway and you can't stop until you finally stop. I know what that is. That's a hopeless state of mind and body. That's completely different than, you know, my mother doesn't like me, you know, or the boss looked at me funny, or whatever the crap is we're talking about at the discussion meetings now. That's a hopeless state of mind and body, and I've been recovered from that for 32 years. And so have you. But then there's a whole other thing going on. There's a thing, but because the alcohol apparently is just a symptom of disease. Did you know it was a symptom? It's a pretty crappy symptom. You know, it's a serious symptom. My life became a bottle. It was a big symptom. But apparently the real disease centers in my mind, not my body. As a matter of fact, I didn't even suffer from alcoholism before I got here. All I suffered from was drunk. Drunk is different than alcoholism. Drunk is something that happens to you when you don't want to suffer from alcoholism. That's what I used. I used alcohol. See, I used alcohol because no amount of clothes, no amount of money, no title, no woman, no nothing ever worked just as well as just a few drinks. It's not that the other things didn't work well. And they did work from time to time. That's why I used them. That's why after I come in here, I continue to chase them and use them, much to my detriment. But the fact of the matter is nothing works quite as well and quite as fast as just a few drinks. So I drank, and I defy anybody to drink alcohol and I would do for them what it did for me and stop. You ain't going to do it. It just brought it all together. But unfortunately, alcohol doesn't work for me anymore, so I stopped drinking it. And the real unfortunate thing is alcohol stopped working for me about 10 years before I realized it stopped working for me, and I hurt a lot of people. I hurt a lot of people, and I hurt myself. You know, and my problem was, you know, and I hurt myself, and I wound up at 31 years old where I lost everything. I think the most important thing I lost was me, my self-esteem, any self-respect I had, because basically I became, and I was a nothing. I was always going to be. It didn't matter I was a lawyer. It didn't matter I was a prosecutor. It didn't matter what degrees I had. Didn't matter what car. I was a nothing. I knew I was a nothing. I was always going to be a nothing. I used to throw something in my body, it would turn me into an almost. When you're nothing, almost is top of the world. And that's what I settled for, almost, every Friday night when I slugged down the alcohol. And so it says, if you want what we have and you only go to any length to get it, it says, rarely have you seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. That's what it says, right? And their path had nothing to do with reading the big book. You understand that, don't you? In 1939, they were 4 years sober. They had been rocking in the fourth dimension of existence. They had experienced much of heaven. They were amazed at what happened. that had a relationship with God. Bill Wilson even said to Bill Dotson, in Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease that I got to keep talking about it and telling other people. So amazed by this. Their relationship with God had just so propelled them into something that was even more, a different level of living and existence, an abundant life, a different level of living and existence that they had to keep on telling about. They were enthusiastic. They weren't hanging in there. They were rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence. And so they wrote this book and they said, rarely have I seen a person fail who has slowly followed our path. And their path was reading the Holy Bible, praying to God, having prayer sessions every morning, having their men get down on the knees before they went into a meeting. That's what they used to do, and give their lives over to God, surrender to God, and then they would let them in the meeting. That's what they did. That's what their lives were about. It was about reading Matthew 5, 6, and 7. It was about 1 Corinthians 13, and it was about the book of James. And they wrote the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, all that is in there. All the principles, everything from the Bible is in there. Because, of course, most people don't know the Bible. If they knew it, they'd say, this is the Bible. This is what's in the Bible. It's all in there. And then after the book was published and it came out, since alcoholics are defiant in the extreme and the hackles on neck raise up and whenever we talk about God, even though the big book says if a mere code of morals and a better philosophy of life would have saved us, we would have been so better long ago, but those things didn't save us because what we had was a lack of power. Power is our deliverance. So we wrote a book where we had to talk about God. We had to find the power. We had to talk about God. And that's what pisses alcoholics off. And what happened is after they published the book Alcoholics Anonymous, droves and droves of alcoholics came in who didn't want to believe in God anyway. We still have them in here today, most of the fellowship, most of the fellowship. And they discovered something amazing. They discovered something amazing. That you could stay sober, physically sober, for long periods of time, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, without believing in God, without developing a belief in God. All you had to do was not drink and go to meetings. And of course, treatment centers, basically, not because they're bad or good, basically that's what they told people when they'd say about the God, these, don't worry about that, just don't drink and go to meetings. And so when you took hundreds of alcoholics that didn't want to do this thing in the first place, because they're defined in the extreme, and that's our basic characteristic, and you don't want to believe in God anyway, and you want to do anything to water this thing down or somehow look at the loopholes and, you know, well, that's my program, not your program. And all of a sudden, they basically are being told, well, all they got to do is don't drink, go to meetings, don't worry about all the other stuff. What do you think most of the alcoholics opted to do? Now, of course, the basic text, thank God it's here, the book Alcoholics Anonymous, where all it does is talk about developing a relationship with God. And thank God the 12 and 12 is there, where that's all it talks about. As a matter of fact, in the sixth step, it talks about separating the men from the boys. You ever hear that in the sixth step? This is the step that separates the men from the boys. And the test is, which is developed by a well-known clergyman, which probably surprised you because by going to Alcoholics Anonymous in this century, you probably think that AA is against listening to the fellowship. You know, I'm talking about, you know, the wisdom of the rooms, the fellowship, Well People's Anonymous here. Listening to the fellowship, you probably think we're anti-religion, anti-organized religion. But of course, the book Alcoholics Anonymous, which is pure AA, says we lose all prejudice even against organized religion. We begin to see where religious people is right. So actually, sober people aren't prejudiced against organized religion. They don't put down organized religion. They look to see where organized religion is right. So the people you hear in Alcoholics Anonymous that put that down, they're really not sober. But that's okay. There are a lot of people in the group, and you want to believe them anyway. So what happens is, even though it says a well-loved clergyman says the test for separating the men from the boys is any man who is willing to grow repeatedly throughout his lifetime in the image and likeness of his creator with a capital C, meaning the deity, is a man, and the rest are boys, and then ultimately you discover that most of Alcoholics Anonymous, 95%, are mostly boys, and maybe 3 or 4% are men. And then it all depends on who you hang around with, because the men or women you'll be in the next 5 or 10 years will depend on the people you hang out with and the books you read, and trust me, the books you read will depend upon the people you hang out with. So you get to settle for either not drink and go to meetings deal. That's the one, you know, there's two doors in AA. The first door is we stop drinking, the not drinking club, you know. You know, the only requirement to get in is the desire to stop drinking, the not drinking club. And of course, the sad part about that is those people always, if you stand behind that door, and there's thousands of people behind that door, people always end up drinking anyway. They either end up drinking after 5 years, 10 years, or 15 years, or they live lives of quiet desperation even though they're sober. And then there's another door. There's not thousands of people standing behind that door. There's only two or three. And on that door, it has on top of that door, it says, "Experience much of heaven. We've been rocking in the fourth dimension of existence." And every once in a while, you hear somebody go, see somebody go from that side of the room, from the not drinking door, to the rocking in the fourth dimension door. But you never see them go from the rocking fourth dimension door over to the not drinking door. And that's how it works. Yeah. And that's the deal. So, in any event. So this is from the book Alcoholics Anonymous. This is some of those guys that got sober for the first 4 years. Remember I talked about the guys in the first 4 years? This is what they were about. This is what these men were about. You know, the guys that got sober for the first 4 years, because here's what you need to do. You need to get Dr. Bob and the good old timers. It's conference approved. Of course, there's nothing that's conference disapproved, but it's conference approved. Dr. Bob and the good old timers. And you need to read, because that's a book which specifically states, not generally, what they did the first 4 years, and actually about 10 years after that, because it took about 4 or 5 generations until we got to the position we are right now where people get nervous when you talk about God and AA. I mean, God, you say the word Jesus or, you know, the Bible, it clears the room. But that's only because they're mostly filled with immature babies in here. People are spiritually immature and scared, because if you're scared, there's something wrong with you, I'll tell you that. If Jesus will hurt your feelings, you don't have a shot out there, I can tell you that. You don't have a shot. Because I'll tell you, this disease will hurt you a hell of a lot more than he will. Okay, let's go. Here we go. Let's hear what these guys were like, okay? This is Alcoholics Anonymous. He sold himself short, okay? Here it is. Let me see. It's one of my favorite stories, but basically it's just a... "These last 18 years have been the happiest of my life, trite though the statement may seem. 15 of those years I would not have enjoyed had I continued drinking. Doctors told me before I stopped that I only had 3 years at the outside to live. This latest part of my life has had a purpose, not in the great things accomplished, but in daily living. Courage to face each day has replaced the fears and uncertainties of earlier years. Acceptance of things as they are has replaced the old impatient chomping at the bit to conquer the world. I have stopped tilting at windmills and instead have tried to accomplish little daily tasks, unimportant in themselves, but tasks that are an integral part of living fully. Where derision, contempt, and pity were once shown me, I now enjoy the respect of many people. Where once I had casual acquaintances, all of whom were fair-weather friends, I now have a host of friends who accept me for what I am. And over my AA years, I have made many real, honest, sincere friendships that I shall always cherish." Have you all heard anything about money yet? Have you heard anything about cars or homes or jobs or employers or all the stuff you talk about in the discussion meetings? Have you heard of any of the stuff you talk about or you heard talked about in the discussion meetings? Well, he hasn't mentioned that. Well, I think it's coming up. Here it comes. "I'm rated as a modestly successful man." Okay, here we go. "My stock of material goods isn't great. I'm broke." What's that all about? I was riding with Ray O'Keefe once in a car, and I said, when will I get rid of financial insecurity? He said, never. I said, no, seriously. I had about 3 or 4 years, and I was always worried about money. You know, that lasts for what, how long? About 10, 15, 20 years. So I was running out. So I was saying, no, seriously, when will that thing happen to me where I'm not worried about financial, because I was always worried about money, you know, I was always worried about money. I said, no, when will I have financial security? I won't have my financial security. He says, never. He says, you'll never have that. He says, no, I'm serious. I want to know. He says, Russell, you'll never have financial security. He said, the book says I'll have financial. He says, no, it doesn't say that. He says, it does. It says. He says, it doesn't say that. It says, I'm lose financial insecurity. He says, it doesn't say that, Russ. He says, here's the book. He was driving. He says, why don't you read it? So I turned the page. It says, we will lose fear of financial insecurity, people in a financial insecurity. He says, you see, he says, you won't lose financial. You just learned fear of it. He says, Russ, you're always going to be broke. It just won't bother you. Fear. Thanks, Ray. I appreciate that. Fear of people, but I love people. I always drank in bars with 300 people. He says, well, if you love people so much, why did you always have to be drunk to be around them? Why did you always have to be drunk to have sex? Why did you always have to be drunk to ask a girl to dance? Why did you always have to be drunk to be around them? Why were you always scared when you went to a wedding or any type of gathering? What am I going to do? We're worried about your drinking if you love people. Truth is, you hate people. You're scared of people. You think they're judging you. You're worried about what they think about you. The truth of the matter is that you're totally insecure when it comes to being around people. You're either a bragger, you're either too loud, or you're too quiet. You feel totally uncomfortable, and you've always been that way. And whenever you use alcohol to make you feel good about, make you to allow you to do anything, you lose the ability to do that thing without the alcohol. So if you use alcohol to be around people, you lose the ability to be around people with the alcohol. No matter what you use alcohol to do, it becomes a crutch. So I'm rated as a modestly successful man. My stock of material goods isn't great, but I have a fortune. Here it comes, the fortune. I have a fortune in friendships, courage, self-assurance, and an honest appraisal of my own abilities. Above all, which I think means, you ready for this? Because I'm a wordsmith. Above all. It's one of those words that you really have to pay attention to. Above all, I have gained the greatest thing accorded to any man. Oh man, this guy probably gets laid all the time. Well, no, that's the deal, isn't it? Because I've been watching TV, and every other commercial, I guess they make billions of dollars, all of this, is basically telling me I'm a piece of crap because I can't have a hard-on for 4 hours. No, don't you see that, Viagra, that you're a piece of crap? And I was driving along the street out there, and I saw this beautiful gal in a bathing suit with big, you know, whatevers, and it said, that breast, you know, enlargement. That probably cost about $8,000, and I looked at that, and I said, if I had one of those, I'd be okay, you know. I'd be okay with one of those. And you know why I think they put those up there? Because I think women look at it and say, gee, if I had two of those, I'd be okay. Because it's just another mirror into the person's soul that tells them they're totally insufficient, they're pieces of crap, because the world judges you by whether or not you have big tits. Yeah, I know you're laughing. You don't know what it's like. I charged up more credit cards spending money I don't have on things I don't need to impress people I don't even like than you could possibly imagine. Because that's all alcoholism is about. All alcoholism is about is chasing idols and chasing crap that you chased before you got in here that'll think you think will make you okay, that'll never make you okay, but you continue to chase it and manage your life and worry about that crap. Instead of focusing on the only thing that the world cannot take away from you and the only thing you have to develop a relationship with in order to be okay and feel good about yourself, and that is a relationship with God, and you don't even want to do that, you'd rather use good, orderly direction, which is basically a philosophy of life which the big book says doesn't work, you know, rather than rely on a deity, because if you could do good, orderly direction, then you don't need God because you'll do good, orderly direction. But, of course, who decides what's good, orderly direction? Who decides that? Oh, you do. And that's funny, especially when you're dealing with a book that says, first of all, we had to quit playing God. And that's how we play God. We make up these little philosophies, do the next right thing, good orderly direction, which sounds great. How can anybody argue against it? But it wasn't good enough for us because we lacked the power to have good orderly direction. Because somehow, some way, when it comes right down to it, I just don't want to give back the money. Above all, I have gained the greatest thing accorded to any man, the love and understanding of a gracious God. There he is again. Who has lifted me from the alcoholic scrap heap to a position of trust where I've been able to reap the rich rewards that come from showing a little love for others and from serving them as I can, which is probably why in the front of the book it says something like this. We have found much of heaven and we've been rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today. When they're talking about the central fact of our lives today, I think what they mean, you know, I love this. It says the great fact is just this and the great fact. You know, they use that one other time, the tremendous fact and the great fact, and it's all about the exact same thing. The great, you know, I think if you're reading a book that says the great fact is this and nothing less. First of all, I think what that means is it's this and nothing less than this. When they say the great fact is this and nothing less, it says It says the central fact of our lives today. The central fact, that means the thing you think about all the time, the thing you focus on all the time, the thing that's most important to you all the time. Oh, it must be the same thing as this guy was talking about when he said, I've gotten the greatest thing accorded to any man. That was a great fact for him. It was a great fact for them. It was a great fact for the first 100 people in here who were rocking in the fourth dimension of existence. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is deep miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves, which is probably why the promise is saying God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Which is probably why later on in the book they say something like this: perhaps there is a better way. We think so, for we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We're in the world to play the role He assigns. Just to the extent that we do as we think He would have us and humbly rely on Him, does He enable us to match calamity with serenity. We never, ever, ever apologize. We never apologize for talking about God. Never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is a way of weakness, paradoxically is a way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fears and direct our attention to what He would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. So I'm driving up here today, and, you know, like Abraham said to Isaac as he marched him up the mountain, the Lord will provide. I always, people ask me whether I ever think about what I'm going to talk about before I talk, and you can tell by this talk I obviously don't, but no, because, you know, the truth of the matter is what's important in Alcoholics Anonymous is that you become transparent, and that's what I only pray for. You know, I do that old Testament prayer: may the words of my mouth, the meditation of my heart be acceptable to you, my God, my Lord, my rock and my redeemer. And I just know He'll give me the words to say whatever the words are, because even though, just as alcoholics recognize horseshit and bullshit artists and phonies, because we are all phonies and full of shit, and we know we're phonies and full of shit, we're all cynical. Alcoholics are cynics. They're not skeptics are saying, well, I don't know one way or the other. Cynics are, it's all bullshit. When you're talking to a group of alcoholics like this, you know, 80% of them are saying, this is all bullshit, this guy's bullshit, I can't believe this guy, he's bullshit, they ought to listen to me, it's all bullshit, I'm bullshit, you're bullshit, they're bullshit, it's all bullshit, the whole world is bullshit, it's just a bunch of bullshit, you know what I mean? So you already start out underneath the water, you understand what I'm saying? Dragging your way up, because the people are just looking at you, they're waiting to explain to you, you're full of shit, you know what I mean? Because they're full of shit, and they know full of shit, and they know you're full of shit. You understand what I'm saying? But you see, that same thing, since we know so much how full of shit we are, what floors an alcoholic is authenticity. See, that's what really gets us. That's why Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and a good A, man, I'll tell you, if you could just be sincere and transparent in an AA meeting, man, it's a great AA. And once you learn how to fake that, you got it made. But the bottom line is, it's the truth. The truth is, people recognize when you're being honest and being transparent and talking about your life, and that's why our testimony is so important. That's why our stories are so important. You know? And when you stop living in fear, which is really the corrosive thread, worrying about what people think about you, worrying about what's going to happen to you, a life without fear, which has to do really with the true promises, permanent life without fear, which happens to do with the real freedom, the new freedom, and the new happiness. And you're losing the fear of people, losing the fear of all the other stuff around you. So you can talk without worrying about, well, should I say this, or shouldn't I say that, or shouldn't I mention Jesus, should I mention the Bible, what would they think? I mean, there's Jewish people in the audience, you know. But when you stop that bullshit, and you just start talking about yourself and your life, well, first of all, you can talk faster. That's number one. Right off the bat, you can talk faster. So you can squeeze in 4 hours into like 1 hour, okay? Because you're no longer running through the worrying about the judgment of people and stuff like that, or, you know, what are they going to think about me? Because you're not worried about what they're thinking about you. Because you're a bunch of alcoholics, you only worry about what your Lord thinks about you, what God thinks about you, because He's the central fact of your life, and He's the most important thing in your life. And He knows if you're up there trying to do the best you can and just trying to carry a message like you did to that kid. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter, because you're doing His will, and I'm on the earth to perform His will, not your will. I'm the earth to be me based upon me, I think he wants me to be and perform his will. And when that's your life, and that's what A is all about, and that's what this book is all about, and you have a God and you have a relationship with him, you no longer have to worry about what the damn world thinks about you or whether or not you're going to have a 4-hour erection. You don't have to worry about that stuff. You don't have to chase after all the crap the world says you have to have in order to be okay. You don't have to have the car. It doesn't mean you won't have the car. It doesn't mean you won't have the girl. It doesn't mean you won't have the house. But you don't have to have. It isn't necessary for your happiness. It's just not necessary for your happiness. And you don't have to drink because it never gets that bad because you're not restless, irritable, and discontented. Because how could you be restless, irritable, and discontented when you've got the greatest thing that's been accorded to any man, the love and understanding of a gracious God who's lifted you from the alcoholic scrap heap? How can you ever have that deal going on? You know what I mean? And you can go out there and help people. And alcoholics, when you got that deal going for you, see, they recognize authenticity. And they understand you're authentic and you're talking about it because they come in here thinking that nobody will ever understand them because they're so unique, they're so different. That's our flag. You know, I'm different, I'm unique, nobody can ever understand me, nobody can ever understand the way I think and feel. And then all of a sudden some guy's talking about from the podium about stuff that you've been thinking that you don't even know you've been thinking. And you've been thinking. And all of a sudden you know they're telling the truth because holy shit, that's the stuff that's been bothering me. And that's the way I think all the time. And I know this guy's telling the truth because this is my truth. And I thought I was the only one who was doing this thing. And then you realize that not only aren't we not different, we're all basically twins. Even though some are fat, some are skinny. It's like talking to my twins, you know what I mean? Except there's hundreds of you, thousands of you, millions of you, you know? And so if I thought something, you thought it. That's a scary thing, right? So you see, what happens is I ended up knowing more about you than you know about you. So you get to sponsor people and you tell them stuff and they say, no, that's not true. And I say, yes, it is true. And they say, no, it's because you know them. They don't even know them. You know them better than they know them because you are them and you've been them and you've gone through them. And so you know what they're all about and they don't even know what they're all about. So they're arguing with you saying they're not what you know they are. And if they stay sober, one day they come up to you and say, I used to hate you, but now I love you, you know? Shit like that, you know? Crap like that. So I'm driving up here today. And, I'm going to end this. We have 2 minutes. I'll end this on a bittersweet note. I know it's about the first time. I don't know what it is, but the Lord gave this to me, so I figured it's been on my heart, so I'm going to give it to you. So I'm driving up here, and I'm a lawyer. I mean, I'm a practicing attorney. Been doing it for many years, 35 years. And I have websites, I have all that stuff that you have, your attorney, people know. And every once in a while I get a call from people who find me on the internet or whatever, and I get a call tonight from this. I get a call. I'm having pizza with some of the guys. And I call up and this gal's voice comes on the phone and I said, can I ask you a question? And it sounds like a kid. You know, like the voice of a 10 or 11 year old. And I said, who is this? And he says, my name's Jocelyn. And I said, and I have, you know, 3 daughters and a son. I've been married 32 years, 3 daughters and a son. And I got six grandkids. And, you know, I love little girls. And I have 3 gorgeous daughters. And I said, who is this? He says, my name's Jocelyn. I said, how old are you, Jocelyn? And she says, I'm 15. So I said, well, Jocelyn, what are you doing at 15 years old calling up a lawyer? He says, well, my daddy said I should try to call up a lawyer. He could ask him a question. I said, well, you know, I'm in the middle of a restaurant. I said, but why don't you go ahead and ask me the question, and I'll see if I can answer it, you know? And she says, well, my daddy's in jail for drugs. And I want to know whether there's a way I can get him out so he can go to my 15th birthday. Aww. That's what this disease is all about. It's not even about you. You think it's about you. It's about Jocelyn. It's about that little girl. You know, I had a little boy and a wife, and I'll tell you about this next time, that I left. When he was 5 years old, I walked out the door. And I walked out the door because my wife said it's either us or the alcohol. And I chose the alcohol. And I said, I'm free. I chose the alcohol and I said, I'm free. It's about Jocelyn. That's what this deal is about. That's what's at stake. And every person in here has their Jocelyns there. You understand what I'm saying? This guy that's in jail, see, I don't even feel sorry for him. I honestly don't. You know, when I sponsor guys, and I don't feel sorry for them. I feel sorry for their kids. You know, I've raised 4 kids and 6 grandkids. I'm raising them. You know, kids need sober daddies and mommies. I don't feel sorry for them. I feel sorry for their children. That has to grow. I grew up with an alcoholic mom. She got sober, God bless her. You know, I feel sorry for their kids. So next week we'll talk about something else. Thank you very much.